Well, hello and welcome to today's episode of Breaking the Taboo. And today we're going to have an important episode to talk about premature babies and life in NICU. And I'm delighted to have with me today two expert guests. And we have firstly Dr. Chris Dewhurst, who is the Medical Director at Liverpool Women's Hospital. And Chris is a neonatologist, and his hospital delivers approximately 7,500 babies each year. He's also been the clinical director for both neonatal and maternity services in Liverpool. And alongside his medical leadership role, he provides clinical care on the neonatal intensive care unit, where he has a particular interest in neonatal ventilation and has been driven to minimise health inequalities. And I'm also delighted to have with us Selena Bagnell, who is a commercial litigator with a top 40 national law firm, Freets LLP. But more importantly for today's episode, she's also a mum to Sam, born at 24 plus 2 weeks gestation, and Ava, born at 36 plus 5 weeks gestation, and wife to Martin. She now actively supports and advises the neonatal unit at the same hospital in Liverpool, and also the Alderhay Children's Hospital, on family integrated care and parents' experience. So can I welcome you both so much to the studio today, and what an important subject to talk about. And I should start by saying we read a lot of listener feedback from every week, the messages that we get sent on social media and on email. And this is one of the topics which we've had most requested by the public to learn more about. And it's the first time that we've had a dedicated episode on it, even though we have referenced it in earlier conversations. So perhaps, Chris, I could start with you. And for anyone listening to the show who's less familiar with this topic, firstly, what is prematurity in babies? And what does that actually mean? I mean, how small are the babies that we're talking about?
Oh, thank you, Theo, and good morning. And thank you for inviting me on to talk about prematurity. So prematurity is a really important factor, both in our baby's health, but also in our population health. So if we think about premature babies, what we're talking about is babies born less than 37 weeks gestational age. So we know that a baby should be inside its mum for 40 weeks, but some babies do come early, and we define prematurity as that less than 37 weeks. But there's varying degrees of prematurity, and we sort of break them up arbitrarily between 32 and 37 weeks, where we'd call moderate preterm, then very preterm between 28 and 32 weeks, and then extremely preterm below 28 weeks. But the smallest babies that we're looking after now are right down there at 22 weeks gestational age. So you can imagine that's over 4 months before you're expecting to see your baby. You might see your baby and be born. And we're looking after babies. Unfortunately, I often work in grams, but so I'll try and think of that in pounds and ounces. But we're looking after babies sometimes from as small as 350 grams, which I think is about 2/3 of a pound. And these are the ones that are right at that extreme prematurity. So if you think of the whole group of premature babies, and I was chatting to Zelina earlier, I actually had a premature baby and thought that was a bit strange because I didn't expect them to come, but that was at 36 weeks. My firstborn sailed through, had no problems, and was home within 24 hours. But if we think of the babies right down as those extreme gestational ages, they've got a lot to do to get home. And to put it very simply, there's a reason you stay inside your mum for 40 weeks or 9 months, and that's for all your organs to form and all your organs to develop, for it to be able for you to sustain life outside of your mother's uterus.
That's so helpful. And can I just say, what happens to babies that are so little? I mean, what is the difference in outcomes between what you're just describing, which is if they haven't made it to full term and they are being born so early, just so I understand what the difference is?
The main problem is all the organs aren't formed. So if we think about their lungs aren't ready to take gas in and out, they haven't got the muscles to breathe sufficiently, their hearts aren't ready to beat as strongly outside their mothers, their bowels aren't ready to take milk, and their kidneys aren't ready. So everything is maturing, but the babies unfortunately appear early. We know that if we look at the survival of babies, the very limit we will go to now is around 22 weeks, where we will intervene for babies. And we know that if those babies are born alive, then probably around 2 to 3 in 10 will make it home, which will mean the most of those babies will sadly not survive. We also know if they do make it home that around about half of those babies are going to have severe and moderate disabilities when they grow up. And as we approach 28, 29 weeks, the chances of survival are actually very similar to if you're born at full term. It's just that it's going to take a number of weeks for all your organs to mature and for you to be able to take your milk and breathe, to be able to then go home. But we even know in those babies, even if you're a little bit premature, that you are going to have some or increased risk of difficulties as you get older.
That's a really helpful place to start, Chris. And Selena, if I could bring you in, I remember when I had my daughter, I was so planned, you know, trying to organise maternity leave and getting the house ready and thinking that you have the full 40 weeks. And in my case, my daughter was late, so I had extra time. So I can imagine it's very difficult when it's the reverse and suddenly your baby is arriving much, much sooner than you were expecting them to. So could you just share with listeners what happened to you when you gave birth to Sam?
Yeah, of course. So I was 23 weeks when I first experienced some problems. I'd had a very normal pregnancy up until that point, no issues, some morning sickness, nothing else, sailed through, absolutely fine. At 23 plus five, I was working from home. It was COVID at the time, so everybody had been grounded already. Boris had just made the announcement to tell everybody to stay at home. I had a court case, a virtual court case on screen, and I thought I'd overdone it that day. I'd been exerting, I had, you know, obviously been arguing, and I came away from that hearing with some quite sharp pains in my stomach. I told HR that I wasn't feeling well, and they insisted that I stay at home the next day to rest and not work. Fine, did that, pains went off, no problem. The pains returned double the next day. And so I rang my local triage at Leighton Hospital and said, something's not quite right. I'm not quite sure about this. What do you think? And they said, let's just have you in. Come in, let's just check it over. It'll be nothing, but let's just check. Fine, no problem. April 2020 was one of the hottest Aprils on record. I wandered in a little summer dress and a pair of flip-flops, not thinking anything of it. Sat down in triage. My husband wasn't allowed in because it was COVID. He had to sit in the waiting in the car. And there was just me and one other lady who was 40 weeks waiting to be induced. They called me through and examined me, and the nurse said, I'm ever so sorry to tell you this, but you're 3 centimetres dilated. You're going to give birth today. And I was so shocked because I'd never heard of this level of prematurity before. I thought she'd got it wrong. And I said to her, you're not confusing me, are you, with the lady that's in the waiting room? She's 40 weeks, not me. And she said, no, Zelina, you're dilated. You're going to give birth. This is extreme prematurity. And I was so shocked. I just couldn't believe it. And she gave me a decision. She said, we're now faced with the decision of whether we fight or we let Sam go. I couldn't possibly make that decision without my husband being in the room, although I knew what his answer would be. And I begged them to let him come in. They allowed it. And immediately both of us said, fight. Now, Leighton Hospital is not a tertiary hospital, and therefore it cannot look after babies born at less than 28 weeks gestation. So they knew they needed to get me out of there ASAP. They rang around local hospitals. At the same time, they gave me steroids to protect Sam's lungs and magnesium to protect his brain. I don't know if anybody has experience of magnesium, but what it does is effectively sets a fire inside you and you burn from the inside out. That is the side effect of taking magnesium. It also makes you very sick. But happily, in between throwing my guts up, I managed to say to the lady that was shouting over to my husband, we've got Birmingham Women's or we've got Arrow Park up in Liverpool. Which one? I shouted, go north, because I was from the north. I knew I wanted to go back up north. And thank God I did, because Arrow Park managed to hold on to Sam then for another 10 days. They elevated me in a bed. And it is just as basic as it sounds. They tilted the bed and gravity did its work. And I held on to Sam until 24 plus 2. Experienced some real pains. I was so early, I didn't understand what labour pains were. I hadn't done Lamar's, I hadn't done any NCT class, nothing. I had no knowledge of pregnancy yet. I thought it was a stomach ache. Didn't feel any worse than that. Within minutes, my waters broke, and within 40 minutes, Sam was here.
Wow. And what's so interesting, listening to what you were just saying, Zelina, is how you felt completely unprepared. I mean, you'd just basically been at work and then suddenly you were being told you were going to hospital and the next time you come out is going to hopefully be with your baby. You so check. How was that in terms of dealing with everything else around you, obviously not being able to go back into work the next day, presumably trying to sort out kind of everything as a kind of emergency situation, not even having your hospital bag? How did you cope in that scenario? And what advice would you give to other mothers in a similar situation?
I know that one of my fortes is being organised. So even at the point that the magnesium was taking hold and I was being incredibly sick, I was also on my phone making a list of things for my husband to run back and get for hospital bag purposes. The hospital said, you've got 40 minutes before this ambulance comes. You've got that time to get home, get things and get back. We won't talk about the speed he went because certainly it does not take just 40 minutes to go from and to the hospital from our house. But he did it. But in that time, we were making a list, getting the hospital bag sorted, notifying parents, notifying neighbours, because the house, they were telling us we weren't going back to this house for possibly 4, 5, 6 months. And I was saying, but hang on, the windows are open. You know, we've just come out for a quick visit. And so we were having massive decisions that we were having to make within a 24-hour period. And the enormity of it is not something I can advise parents to prepare for, because I don't think you can. I think all you can do in that moment is deal with it as it comes and process as much as you can.
For anyone listening to the show today, I think it's really important to prepare for the unexpected. So my baby was late, not early, but I nearly ended up having an emergency C-section due to complications. And I also didn't have my hospital bag with me. So I think there's a lesson in there, and always be prepared and make sure you've got a few basic things ready to go regardless. So Chris, if I could just come back to you, and what is the main reason then that babies are admitted to NICU? And could you just explain a bit about what that is? Because it is a different ward in the hospital. Not every parent will have seen it, been aware of it, know what it is. Yep. If we could just start with introducing what NICU is.
Yeah, sure. So wherever you have a people delivering babies in hospital, there will be some degree of neonatal service there. And there's three main levels of neonatal unit. There's and Zelina spoke about being in Leighton, they would have a level two unit. So they can look after some premature babies and some sick babies, but not the most premature nor sickest. And then there's a level one unit that would look after even more mature babies. And where Zelina was sent is a level three neonatal unit, which would call a neonatal intensive care unit. And the two main reasons babies are admitted to the neonatal unit is for prematurity, like as Zelina described. And the other reason is term babies who are sick, and some of those are unexpected. So that is babies who might not have had enough blood and oxygen around the time of delivery, and some of those are predictable, and these are babies whom during pregnancy we may have scanned and found that the baby has an issue or a problem that means they need urgent care the moment they're born. So those are the main reasons the babies are admitted. I think I know that neonatal intensive care units are very scary places to be, because Zelina can tell you her story much more eloquently than I will be able to put this, but no one expects this to happen. And a lot of time, I think these things happen at a time in our lives where for most of us, things have gone quite well. We've met our partners, we've got married, we've got pregnant, everything's going well. And all of a sudden something happens. And for me, there's a thing around the enormity of the prematurity, but also this acceptance that life doesn't always go as you might expect it to go. But when you arrive on the neonatal unit, it's full of alarms and noises and funny smells and strange people in uniforms. And in the middle of it is this small person who is your son or daughter that you need to focus on. But I think it must just be overwhelming. So what we try and do for our families is try and prepare them for this journey. And that's what Zelina was referring to, that this conversation about what do we do and what will it be like for the next few months. And I've had that conversation many, many times. And I'm almost certain Zelina will tell us this phrase was used. We often describe it as a roller coaster, because day one, baby arrives, and most premature babies do quite well in the first few hours of life. So everything seems to be going quite well. And then complications hit. And those complications will affect hearts, eyes, bowels, everything that we can think of. And I remember Sam had a number of these complications. There's an emotional roller coaster that we go through. You're far away from home. You're not expected to be here. And our role is obviously to provide the medical care, but also to work with families to ensure that the experience is, and I don't want to use this in the lightly, but as positive as it can be, because also you will not get this time with your newborn baby back. So that's where we bring in this concept of bringing the families in to look after the babies with, is called family integrated care.
And I love to talk a bit more about the role of the families. But just before we get there, Zelina, I've been to visit mothers who've had a baby in a NICU. And I think the first thing that struck me was obviously your baby's in an incubator, and it's not just on your, you know, chest lying in a normal hospital bed in a ward, as probably most mothers are expecting. So that's incredibly difficult. And I've heard from mothers who felt like they didn't have, firstly, the initial birth that they were expecting in that first sort of golden hour of the breastfeeding opportunity or having skin to skin. And I know mothers have found it very difficult in some cases to bond with their baby when they feel that they can't hold it all the time. So could you share a bit about your personal experience and what was difficult, but also what helped in that scenario?
I was taken down for an emergency C-section with Sam. He had become very distressed, and they said that if they didn't get him out there and then, he might not survive. They took me down, and because of COVID, again, my husband couldn't be with me, so I was all alone. The minute they administered the anaesthetic, I relaxed enough, and he was in such a rush that he stuck his little foot out and they just pulled him out. So it was considered a natural birth, but Sam was alone when he was born. I was unconscious. Martin wasn't there. He was taken straight to the NICU. And the first time I saw him, Chris is absolutely right, the enormity of those alarms and seeing this very tiny 790 gram baby, 1 pound, 13 ounces, covered in tapes, covered in wires, breathing apparatus on his face, a tube down his throat, a little tiny little baby hat that probably didn't even fit a doll, let alone a baby. I was hugely overwhelmed. I couldn't believe we were in this scenario. And it was almost as if I was outside my body looking down at what was happening. I know a lot of mums have felt very, very traumatized about their bonding experience. I didn't have that. I immediately fell in love with this beautiful little boy, as all mums do, I'm sure, but I didn't feel an inability to bond. What I did feel was very, very, very helpless. I couldn't pick my baby up. I couldn't tell him everything's going to be okay, my darling. I couldn't feed him without somebody helping me to feed him. So did that stop me bonding? No. Did it make me feel possibly like a bit of an outsider and not his mum at the start? Yes, a little bit. When I then was transferred eventually to Liverpool Women's and family integrated care began, I then felt like mum. And that is one of the biggest things for parents. And I think that preserves your mental health whilst you're in NICU, very much so. If you don't feel a part of that journey and you don't feel connected to your child, that can have catastrophic effects for the parents and the baby.
And just listening to what you're saying, Zelina, it reminds me of an earlier episode that we did on series one with fathers, which had a huge response from the public because they're never asked about their experience of birth trauma too. And I remember one of the dads from Fatherhood Solutions, which is a really great charity, said how he wished he discussed with his wife that if something went wrong or if they ended up in the NICU, like, do you want me to be with you or with the baby? And he wished he'd had those conversations earlier and not in the very extreme kind of emergency scenarios which you're just describing. So that's why I think it's so important to have this discussion today so that families start thinking about it, because we will have families today who've been directly affected, but also ones who want to prepare and who are in pregnancy.
Absolutely.
And I think having greater awareness of this is so important.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, my husband was faced with the choice, had to sign a form at the point of cesarean and was told you have to prepare for the fact that your wife might not make it through and your son may not make it through. Please sign here. And he was like, hang on. What? And that's very understandable. You know, and of course, the hospital have to have those conversations. We understand. But I was in such a state of hysteria. And as a lawyer, I don't let my husband sign anything. I was saying, sign it. We've got to save Sam. And my reaction was always, go to Sam. I don't need you. Go to Sam. It's a very personal choice, isn't it? And that is very much, I agree, Theo, a conversation that parents should have. If you're faced with that, who should you go to? That was amplified for us because of COVID. Only one was allowed at his bedside at any one time. And it was always, our priority was always Sam.
When I needed help after my birth trauma, Erwin Mitchell's team of experts provided the support I needed to rebuild my life.
At Erwin Mitchell, we work closely with our clients through any challenges. We understand the impact of a birth injury and can help get the best medical support and rehabilitation for our clients and their families. Authorised and regulated by the Solicitors Regulation Authority.
And Chris, what is the family's role then in care for babies in the NICU?
I'd flip it round and say, what's the doctors and nurses' role in the care for NICU? Because actually, we are only a small part of these children's lives. And at that moment in time, we're a very important part because I think we're doing things to help babies and ultimately to keep them alive and for them to go home. That's our aim. And I think if we go back sort of 20, 30 years in neonatology, it was very much doctor and nurse led. And what we're trying to do on neonatal units is actually make it as parent led as we can possibly make it, because we know that when the babies leave, they don't leave with us as doctors and nurses. They spend the rest of their lives with their parents. So the bonding and the integration of that care in those first few weeks and months of life is really, really crucial. And I've seen that journey myself, working 20 years ago, seeing the involvement, but limited involvement to how we are now. So what we try and do is get parents doing the nursing cares of the baby, so that they will do the feeds or they will change the tubes that need to be changed. The other week I was doing a ward round and there was a set of parents who it was a same-sex couple whom one was a nurse, and she started to ask a lot of questions and we started to have a chat around things and said, okay, tomorrow you're going to present your baby on the ward round. So not the doctors presenting to me, but got her to present. And she knew everything. She knew all of the blood results and she knew all of the latest findings, all the drugs that he was on. And what we found, and Zelina, you did this as well, is absolutely...
I remember you doing this.
Yeah, the parents become the expert in their baby. And we might be the experts in neonatal medicine and how to, what drugs to give and when to do things. But in the baby, it's the parents. And the first question on the ward round should always be, and Zelina, if I didn't do this, I'm sorry, because I'm sometimes...
You did. I know what you're about to say.
What's worrying you today? And then you have to listen. What's worrying you today? And it might be something that doesn't worry us at all, but if it's worrying the family, address that problem, then we'll move on to the medical problems. And we know that if parents do have this integrated care, we get better weight gain, increased feeding, less time on ventilators, discharged home sooner. So it's actually improving the outcome for the babies.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And Zelina, if we could talk a bit about your sort of wider family and your partner. I think what really strikes me as well about listening to this conversation is people just assume you're going to be at home with your baby and on your maternity leave. But in your case, you were not. You were still in the hospital for a significant period of time. And that has severe implications for, you know, your partner going back to work, yourself, you know, as you said, who's looking after your home in that scenario, and other people have other children that they also have to be worrying about. So what do you advise for sort of families in that scenario? Is there any advice that you'd like to give them? And how did you deal with things like not being at home for several weeks at a time?
COVID was a blessing and a curse for us, I guess. COVID meant that once you were in the hospital, you were allowed to remain if you stayed within the hospital. My husband and I obviously stayed within the hospital. COVID meant that family were not allowed to visit. Normally on a NICU, you would see grandparents, you would see brothers, sisters, probably visiting their little brother or sister in the incubator. That wasn't possible for us. It was hugely distressing because for my family particularly, it was their first grandchild. They were faced three times with hearing the news, you might have to say goodbye to him today. And that's not a phone call that any parent ever wants to make or any grandparent ever wants to receive. How did we deal with the home? We're very lucky. We live in a brilliant village with a great community. And I can remember people mowing my lawn, people going into my house and cleaning, people taking delivery of the cot, the baby furniture that I'd ordered weeks before that wasn't due to come until I was 30 weeks gestation, and people just really rallying round. Now we are very lucky because we have the neonatal care and leave bill that has been passed, which allows and affords families an extra 12 weeks fully paid mat leave, pay, neonatal leave, to be at their baby's bedside. And, you know, some people will think, oh, that's just an extended mat leave. No, it's not. When Chris says it's a roller coaster, that is not an exaggeration at all. I spent 4.5 months in hospital with Sam. I then came home to a deluge of hospital appointments in that first 2 or 3 months. I was a medical mum for at least 7, 8, 9 months before I even began to enjoy a maternity leave. And for most people, they may be thinking of going back to work 6, 9 months. Not everybody has the luxury of staying off longer.
That's so true. And in fact, we did a whole episode on that in the last series on going back to work and mums knowing their rights. And I'm so pleased, Lena, that you mentioned the recent bill, because when I was a politician, that was one of the key pieces of legislation that I was lobbying very hard for the government to bring in for all the reasons you've just described. So firstly, well done to the government for bringing in that important bill. And I think it will make a huge difference to families like yourself. And Kristalina also touched on there that, you know, not every baby is going to make it home. And that is a difficult subject, but I think we should break the taboo by speaking about that. So in that really sad situation, you know, what does happen to in the scenario that the baby doesn't sadly survive?
At the start, when we were talking about the survival figures for babies, and we said, you know, at the very extremes, 22, 23, 24, more babies are going to die than survive. We start those conversations with families, and Zelina mentioned this, before they're born. So that you're going into this journey with all the information, and some families decide actually, and Zelina also touched on this, that they, when we give them the risks of babies dying, and if they survive with disabilities, saying that that for them is not something that they're willing to accept, or is not what they think is in their best interest of their baby. And some families at this extreme gestational age will decide, actually, I just want to cuddle my baby when it's born and let them pass in the first few hours of life. That's completely acceptable, and you know, for that family, that's the right thing to do. And then we have other babies who we tried and do things for. So do all the things before babies are born, the steroids and the magnesium, which improve the outcomes for these babies. And then we admit them to the neonatal unit. And it's very unusual for babies to die in spite of the treatment that we're giving them. In other words, we're very good at keeping babies alive. What often happens is we find out more information as we go along this journey that we have to think about whether or not it's the right thing to carry on treating the baby. And these things will be, what do we think the likelihood of survival is? What do we have to put the baby through to survive? So if we have to put them through multiple surgeries and surgery on their belly, surgery on their brains, painful procedures, and what if they do survive, what's their long-term life going to be like? And that is not a decision that we take as doctors on our own. We have those discussions with families, and they're very difficult discussions. And Zelina, you said you had, was it three times you would have had discussions similar to that? And that's not because we're certain, but we'll have the discussion and you know, we're at this point, he needs more surgery. Are we doing the right thing in going for that surgery? We have to ask that question, and then we make the decision about whether or not we think it is the right thing. And I always say to parents, if we decide actually this is too much for the little one, is the reason I come to work and do my job is to get babies home and in as good a condition as we can do. But if we can't do that, we can also do as good a job as we can with that end of life care. So, and the families I've done this with, and unfortunately it's not an infrequent occurrence on a level 3 neonatal unit. It may sound strange, but they actually describe slight a positive experience. And it's this weight that's been sitting on the shoulders of the family of the uncertainty of what's going to happen, which when we give certainty, and even though that certainty is not the outcome they wanted, but we do it in the right way. We give them time. They do memory making where they can take footprints and handprints for the first time. They can wash their baby or cuddle their baby. And they can bring the family in to meet the baby. And when I meet the families after the baby has passed, you often see this relief that we've got to a final point, and it's not the point they wanted to be at, but it is an end point that gives them some positive memories that they can take with them as they move forward. So I think our role as doctors and nurses is to make that end part of their life as positive as possible, and to do it to the best of our ability. And personally, it's sometimes you just think, I really just don't want to do this, but it's part of what we are there to do, and therefore we've got to do it as well as we can.
Well, thank you, Chris, and firstly, it's so heartbreaking to hear those stories, and thank you for everything you and all your team do in all of these units around the country. And for anyone who's listening who is affected by this, then do listen to our episode earlier in this series specifically on baby loss. And we have some help and some practical resources out there where people talk about bereavement counselling and other things that you may find helpful. So do check out that earlier episode. And Zelina, if I could come back to you for a moment, just listening to what you were saying about the very long time that you were actually going in and out of hospital and having appointments, I think it'd be good to talk a bit about sort of life after NICU as well. Like, what's been the journey like for you after discharge, if you could describe that in a bit more detail?
I think the roller coaster that you go on when you're in NICU is volatile. Towards the time when you know you're about to be discharged, you feel a sense of calm. Things have calmed down a little bit. If you're on the way home, your baby is generally doing well. And the whole time that you're in NICU, people wrap their arms around you. You have access to some of the best services anywhere in the world. You have physio, you have endocrinology, you have ophthalmology, you have the very best experts in heart, brain, etc. When you go home, you have a midwife. And for all the best will in the world, the system when you go home needs a hell of a lot of work. You go from being very looked after, very cared for, very supported, to having to find your way a little bit. Now, I was very lucky. My oxygen nurse, Sam, came home on oxygen, was very, very supportive and was the right person to point us to things. But it was me that was saying, when Sam was in hospital, he had physio. He can't move his neck. He's 9 months old now. He doesn't turn his neck. Is that normal? And people were saying, well, let's see, he was premature. Yeah, but he's 9 months, he can't turn his neck. Shouldn't we be trying to intervene here as early as we can to get the best outcome? Again, I'm a vocal person. I didn't feel uncomfortable in having those conversations. But I think if you're a mum or dad that's a little bit more nervous, a little bit more trusting, you might not challenge as much. And it's interesting, Chris, you said that your role was always a secondary role in the NICU, and it was the parents that you... And he used to say this to me, and I used to think he's being very gracious here. Over time, I've thought about that and thought just how important that was. But also, you almost educate the parent to the point that when they leave the NICU, they're armed with that knowledge to be able to go forward. And by gosh, do you need it? So I fought for physio. We fought for sensory OT. We fought for speech and language. And we are still fighting. We have had, unfortunately, to take our local authority to a tribunal to deal with things and you know, get the right outcomes for Sam, because he is now in mainstream education but needs that support. And that is not readily available, and it is something that you have to look for and fight for. Now, the right outcomes have been achieved, and all of the people involved have done their best by Sam, and that's incredible. But there's a lot more support needed for NICU parents and babies.
That's really helpful. And thank you, Zelina, for sharing that. And Chris, from your perspective as a doctor, just explain, like, what would be kind of standard of what parents would be offered once they've been discharged? How much interaction do they still then have with the unit or the team that they've built a good and close relationship with over, you know, a significant period of time?
From a medical point of view, we would arrange follow-up of the babies in clinics. And particularly if you're born extremely preterm, it's highly likely you're going to have, and if you're on oxygen, follow-up with several different doctors in different areas. So it might be the lung doctors, if you're in oxygen, it might be the ophthalmology, the eye doctors. If you've got there's a thing called retinopathy of prematurity, I suspect. And I mean, let's just list who Sam was probably seeing: the surgeons, I suspect, because he had an operation, maybe developmental pediatricians, audiologists, physiotherapists, occupational therapists. So this list goes on and on and on. And I think probably what you're describing, Zelina, is all of this is sort of centered around the child when you're in the hospital, and that they all come to you. But then when you're discharged, well, you've got an appointment on the Monday morning, one on the Monday afternoon, one on Tuesday afternoon, one on Thursday. The communication doesn't happen between these individuals soon enough. And I think you touched on something really important, actually, which is, and we see this a lot, we involve or try and involve families as much as possible in the care on the neonatal unit. And I don't think the rest of the NHS is quite cottoned onto this, and it's still that sort of old traditional medical model of listen to what the doctor says and not that two-way thing as much. I've often thought it would be good actually in adult patients, even, you know, when I always find it strange when an elderly person gets admitted to hospital who's been looked after by their spouse, and then the spouse is only allowed to visit for an hour each day. It just sounds, you know, why aren't they allowed to help? But that's probably another podcast somewhere else. But this is wraparound care, but I don't think it's as joined up as it could or should be.
One thing Chris and I always used to talk about was it was never them and us. It was never the doctors and the parents. It was always a team, and it was always goal orientated. And the goal was get Sam home, get Sam home, get Sam well. And it felt that way. And we felt a part of that. I don't think in 4.5 months I ever missed a ward round, neither did my husband. And in every ward round, I could give you every single figure because the doctors were able to give me every single figure. I knew everything. And that's how we chose to approach it. But very much so, that made for such an easier journey during our time there.
And I think that's a really important message that we see more and more distrust of the medical profession in all lines of work. And I think that message of working together is really important, because I think we see the best outcomes when families and the doctors and nurses work together. I think if you start to get distrust and clashes, it it's never a good place to be. And, you know, to be fair, Zilly, there must have been days you were frustrated with us because we can't have got everything right all of the time. But you managed that really well. You didn't take it out on us, and you accepted probably that not everything will be perfect, because it'll never be. It'll never be. But so thank you for that.
There are several occasions where I came to you and said, "Are you sure?" But not in a defensive way, in a collaborative way of, "What do you think about that? You know, could you just explain it to me again so I understand it? I want to be sure before we go ahead with this." And it was always a good outcome. But I think if you don't work together, it's not a healthy environment, and it's not a positive experience.
And actually, it's so interesting hearing you both talk together, because I think you're the first time on the podcast we've had a mum alongside one of the medical professionals that they worked directly with during their experience. And it's great to hear what a good experience you had both being together as a patient and the doctor. But that leads me on to talk a bit about government policy. And one of the questions I like to ask all of my guests is, you know, imagine that the Prime Minister or the Health Secretary was listening today to Breaking the Taboo. And I should say we do have politicians listening, given my background. So is there anything in particular that you would like the government to do to improve maternity care in the UK? And particularly, how can they support mums with premature babies and their experience in the NICU? And perhaps, Chris, I'll put you in the hot seat first as our resident doctor.
Gosh. Can I have two things, please? One is we need to focus on population health. So in some ways, put me out of a job, please. Reduce the number of babies who are being born prematurely. And the way to do that is yes, some of the things we do in hospitals, but the big drivers are population health, deprivation, maternal health, preconceptual care, all of those things. So despite working in a neonatal intensive care unit that's got all the fancy machines and does all this high technical stuff, the solution to a lot of problems lies within that population. And the second thing is, please pay for maternity services as they need to. So every time a baby is born in our hospital, we lose money. If we were a business, we would be closed down. So basically, the money that is paid to provide maternity services doesn't cover the cost of providing safe, quality maternity services. And what that would do for prematurity is mean that we could scan more women, or identify more women at risk of prematurity and stop them having premature babies, or reduce the risk that they're going to have a premature baby.
Let's hope government is listening today on their commute back from Parliament. And actually, remind me, Chris, in the birth trauma inquiry, which I chaired in Parliament, that was one of our first recommendations, was about increased investments to make sure that the government is prioritising maternity, but also spending money on frontline staff as well, like the doctors, anaesthetists and wards like yourself. Angelina, as a mum, what would you like the government to be doing?
I'm going to be even greedier than Chris and ask for three. Number one, I completely agree. Please fund the maternity services, particularly the NICU services, more. When we were there, we saw how incredibly hard these men and women work. Yes, it's their job. Yes, they're paid to do it. But more often than not, they go over and above the time they should be there, the effort they should put in and what they do. You know, it's incredible. And I should thank everybody at each of the hospitals very much for what they did. Number two, I'd love to see them work more on this neonatal care bill statute as it is now, and develop that further. 12 weeks is great. It's a good start. It doesn't scratch the surface if you give birth to a micropremie, because you're probably still in hospital at 12 weeks. The reality is you are probably still in hospital at 16/20 weeks. And many families can't afford for both parents to be off for that long. We were in a very fortunate position. Not everybody is. And finally, think about the aftercare. When you go home after NICU, life after NICU doesn't end. In fact, in most cases, it's the beginning of the journey. And parents need education. They need support. They need a lot as they go home. And I think the government are the only ones that can give that.
That's such useful advice and good asks, I think, for the government to implement. And we're coming towards the end of the episode. So to finish, I'd love to ask you both my final question, which is a really practical one for families listening to today's episode. Is there a particular resource that you would both like to signpost women to? It could be a particular charity or a podcast or a book or anything that you would find helpful to share. Chris, let me start with you.
So I sit on an advisory panel for a group called Baby Lifeline. And Baby Lifeline are quite unique because they support frontline workers as well as members of the public, but mainly frontline workers in education and buying equipment and training. And they've done a lot around sending supplies actually to Ukraine. But also they do an awful lot of training in the UK for health professionals. And it's the go-to point for real high quality training for our multi-professional teams. So I'd like to signpost them there. It's got lots of interesting information around the work that they do, but also if you were able to do any charitable fundraising, I would support that charity. Thank you.
Well, I'll let you have your cheeky plug, Chris, because I do know Baby Lifeline and they're a fantastic charity. And in fact, I've been to their annual Mum and Baby Awards, which they host in Parliament to recognise all the fantastic work that many of you are doing. And actually just reminded me, they had a brilliant example at this year's awards, which I attended, of hospitals using iPads so that you could live stream and watch your baby when it was sleeping inside the incubator unit, which I thought was a brilliant example.
I was at the same awards, Theo, but I must have missed you. And so, yes.
Well, we're reconnecting today on Breaking the Taboo. And Zelina, what would you like to signpost families to?
I think there are two for me. As a mum having a 24-weeker, I didn't know anything about prematurity. When I went on the internet 5 years ago, there was Bliss, which are great. They are brilliant and a great resource for prematurity. But there was nothing beyond that until I came across Miracle Moon, which is a charity set up to give advice and support to NICU families, whether you're full term, whether you're premature. And it is an incredible resource of information and support. And also a CIC that has recently been set up, Balbeni, which also looks into medical research around prematurity and offers quite a lot of information, again, on NICU, on prematurity. And sorry, there is one more, the Born Charity, which does medical research into prematurity and is looking into why it happens. Because yes, Chris, you did touch on various things in the population, but if you're someone like me that went to a debrief and asked the question, my explanation was, there is no reason, you didn't do anything. You know, it's a big point to make. A lot of these mums will ask, what did I do wrong? Doctor, what did I do wrong? And very often, unfortunately, the answer is nothing.
Well, thank you for those really helpful links. And for anyone listening to today's episode, do have a look at our show notes, where you'll find a number of links in there to the charities that both of my guests have mentioned today. Well, can I thank both of my guests for coming on today's episode of Breaking the Taboo to talk about premature babies and life in NICU. And I found it a really interesting episode. And I think this is something we need to talk more about so that mums are better prepared if and when this does happen to them. So if anyone has been enjoying today's episode or the series, then please do rate us on Spotify or iTunes, and please do share it with other affected families. We want to make sure that as many of you as possible are getting access to the help and the support that you need. So thank you to my guests for joining me on Breaking the Taboo, and stay tuned for next week's episode. Thanks for joining me today, and bye-bye for now.